from Altoona to Beaver Falls, Bedford to Bloomsburg, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, just when Pennsylvania's economy was beginning to reopen, Governor Tom Wolf placed new restrictions on bars, restaurants, and gatherings. David Taylor is joined by Rebecca Euler and Matt Briette for a Capitol Watch roundtable discussion on the impact. And with the National Presidential Nominating Conventions approaching, the time is near for Joe Biden to name his running mate for vice president. I'll have a town hall commentary on why Ready From Day One, Not Identity Politics, should dictate the choice. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to Dave Taylor and our Capitol Watch crew in just a couple of minutes, but first, news headlines from patownhall.com. Governor Tom Wolf is about to do something that likely has never been done in the history of Penn's Woods, veto a bill that has unanimously passed both houses of the General Assembly. Unanimous votes are extremely rare, but Republicans and Democrats in the legislature were united in support of a measure that would require Pennsylvanians' access to public records be maintained, even during a state of emergency. Wolf has suspended the honoring of open records requests at the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. He says he will veto the bill restoring public access to state documents and other records. Criticism of Wolf's stance has been growing steadily from the news media, which depends on the availability of state records to hold government accountable. Wolf opposes the open records bill because he says it would put employees who have to compile that information at risk during a pandemic. Given the broad-based legislative support for reopening the open records process, an override of the governor's veto is likely. The Citizens Alliance of Pennsylvania, a grassroots organization that promotes pro-growth policies, has issued its annual Accountability Index. The index compiles each state lawmaker's vote on key economic issues that come before the legislature. The current index does not include votes on COVID-19-related bills. Additionally, this year, the organization is providing campaign finance information on each legislator, this resulting from an affiliation CAP has with Transparency USA. You can check out how your senator and representative fared by going to empowerpa.org. Driving on the Pennsylvania Turnpike will get even more expensive next year, as the Turnpike Commission has approved a 6% increase in tolls. The fare hike comes as the Turnpike struggles to make payments to PennDOT and the state's mass transit agencies. Those payments are mandated by a law passed back during the Rendell administration. It has siphoned nearly $7 billion in funding from the Turnpike that has triggered what have become annual toll hikes. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. Governor Tom Wolf continues to exercise unchecked power over the state's economy, and in reaction to an isolated spike in COVID-19 cases in Allegheny County, placed new restrictions on bars and restaurants, as well as gathering limits statewide. David Taylor from the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association is here to host a Capitol Watch look at the impact of the governor's latest orders. David?
And welcome once again to Capitol Watch, where we keep an eye on what's happening under the Capitol Dome in Harrisburg for you. I'm your host, David Taylor, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, your team of all-stars, Rebecca Euler, Legislative Director for the National Federation of Independent Business. Rebecca, great to be with you.
Happy to be here again. Thank you, David.
And my main man, Matt Briette, CEO of Commonwealth Partners Chamber of Entrepreneurs. Matt, good to see you.
Good to be with both of you.
Well, thank you, thank you. And, the constitutional crisis continues, that we are stuck in lockdown. And so that means that the emergency declaration remains in place. The courts, as the listeners learned from the last show, that the Supreme Court ruled that the law that says shall does not actually require the governor to do the thing that it said that he shall do. So the emergency declaration continues. Matt, just to benchmark things, where are we in terms of the actual health crisis with the pandemic.
Well, that's the interesting thing, David, is that if we roll this back to when we started, the objective was, again, to flatten the curve. It wasn't to eradicate the virus. We knew that was not going to happen, but simply to make sure we don't overwhelm our medical capacities. And so when it comes to the numbers, frankly, the argument that we are still in a crisis stage just doesn't hold by the very numbers that the Wolf administration is putting out. In fact, when you look at hospitalization, we are under 2% of beds being filled by COVID patients.
Which is good.
Which is good. That's correct. Under 2% of all ventilators are being utilized. And so we're not even close to exceeding our capacities. And yes, while we've seen an increase in cases, the severity is lower. It's amongst a much younger population.
Which is more resilient than younger
correct.
People are.
I mean, some of the numbers are crazy that in terms of the survival rates in Pennsylvania. So if you are 40 years or younger, the survival rate of catching COVID is 99.91%. So that is where, you know, we're seeing an uptick in people younger getting this. But we know that it tends to be mild and you survive. You don't have to be hospitalized. And of course, if you're over 100, you think that you're very susceptible. But believe it or not, 49.8% of 100-year-olds plus have gotten it and survived. And so we're seeing that we're able to care for these things. We have better ways in helping people recover. And so the idea that we're seeing a huge spike and that we're threatening our medical facilities just doesn't hold with a lot of the numbers that are out there, unfortunately.
And again, this is not to pretend that the infection doesn't exist. Of course it does. Doesn't mean we don't have to take counter steps. Of course we do. But things need to be proportional. And
well, we know who this harms the most,
yes,
right? So we can
yes.
protect the most vulnerable people amongst us. But that doesn't mean we should lock down the healthy or the people who will survive and are willing to take those risks, because ultimately we have to empower people to make personal responsible decisions.
And you know, as you said just a moment ago, that the goal was to flatten the curve, not to, you know, eradicate the disease, which is impossible after it's out.
Right. Even with a vaccine, it doesn't eradicate
right.
it. Yes.
And so what would be even more, unachievable would be if no one ever died of anything again. It's like, I'm sorry to break the news, but that this mortal life is impermanent. Like, it's crazy to me that we're going to just, you know, put people in lockdown. We're going to take away their freedom of action, their personal liberty, until nothing bad ever happens to anyone ever again, ever. That's nuts.
Well, along those lines, I mean, we mentioned flatten the curve. That was the goal in the beginning. Everybody was in agreement on that. Does anyone know what the goal is now? Has anyone heard it? You know,
that no one ever gets it again.
Yes.
I mean, it
right,
seems
and
because
that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, because you ask a question to which we're not getting answers from this administration.
Right.
Because we have flattened the curve. We have opened up. But then all of a sudden we had another statewide lockdown. And that just days after the governor said, no, we'll be more strategic about this and allow counties to address this. Yet here as we sit, the entire state has limitations of 25% capacity, basically destroying a lot of more small businesses, which we're already in the top 10 in the country in small businesses, restaurants being destroyed. So it really doesn't make sense. And as you note, Rebecca, we don't know what our end game is here, what the purpose is, what we hope to achieve, and how will we know when we achieve it? So that we can start living again. I think that that's a legitimate question that unfortunately the governor is not answering.
And it certainly undermines our confidence in, you know, him and his administration and his honesty when you see the very spiteful personal political attack that he made withholding federal funds from folks in Lebanon County.
Well, this is, of course, really political payback from the governor toward some county commissioners that reopened the county faster than Governor Wolf wanted. Again, without the metrics driving his decision-making, the county commissioners in Lebanon County, along with the state elected officials, said, look, we've achieved these things. Why are you keeping us in the red? We're declaring ourselves in the yellow. Well, Governor Wolf did not like that, and so is trying to utilize, his emergency powers to override a law that he actually signed during this COVID crisis that directed $13 million to the county of Lebanon. So he has already declared this. A lawsuit has been filed. So he's forcing litigation in order for the county citizens to get the money that Governor Wolf is withholding because of, petty politics and vindictiveness.
A lot of those grants could be used to help small businesses in Lebanon County. So those small businesses are suffering under the new 25% restaurant restriction and other restrictions now, and they have no hope right at this moment of getting any assistance from the state. And that's just atrocious. So I hope that, there's some resolution to that. I understand there's been a lawsuit filed by Lebanon County, and we'll see how that goes at this point. But
there's 140,000 people in Lebanon County, and Governor Wolf is punishing them, not the politicians with which he has a gripe with. So he is harming, and we've got we got black and brown people in the city of Lebanon. So this whole idea that he's going to harm politicians, he's actually harming the very people that he claims he wants to support.
One of the things that we insist upon in our system of government is equal justice under law, and that the law applies equally to everyone, and that the law means what it said. That's why we go through the rigors of a legislative process to enact laws and get them on the books with the consent of the people's representatives. And when you start having the arbitrary uses of power and the law not being followed, and these kinds of personal these episodes of personal pique and spitefulness, I think this is, even though it's one county of 67 and it's a rural county and, like you said, Matt, 140,000 people, for the rest of the 13 million folks in Pennsylvania, can happen to you too.
What businesses need to succeed and to plan is certainty about what their future is going to look like. And they just don't have that right now. I mean, I think that they had some optimism when we all got into the green phase and they were starting to reopen, getting some of their business back. But now that we have this 25% restaurant limitation throughout the entire state, there's so much frustration now. And it's not just with restaurants, which are obviously being impacted a lot, but a lot of small businesses are worried about the future. What's going to be the next thing? Are we going to get closed again? Are we going to be back in red? And you can't run a business. There's no way to run a business like that.
Well, and let me just give you an example. I was out to dinner with one of my members when Governor Wolf announced his most recent closure, giving only hours notice to these businesses. And this gentleman is in the food industry. So trucks had already delivered their food for the next day that were now being limited in what they could sell, what people are going to be coming in and purchasing. And so where Governor Wolf is putting these things out with very little notice, not recognizing the amount of property destruction that is occurring because of these mandates. These are the problems that, unfortunately, and David, as you know, in the manufacturing, Governor Wolf's failure to recognize supply chains and all these things just really demonstrates a continued obtuseness and ignorance about how businesses work, while he continues to claim, well, I was once a businessman. He clearly does not know how many, many businesses operate today and what he's doing to those lives and livelihoods that are connected to them.
You're listening to Capital Watch. I'm your host, David Taylor, from Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association. With me in the studio, Rebecca Euler from NFIB Pennsylvania and Matt Briette from Commonwealth Partners. So, how do we get out of this mess? And so we're under the emergency declaration because the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania said that you can't just pass the resolution ending the emergency declaration, you have to submit it to the governor, who can veto it, which he did, which means now that there has to be a veto override. So I guess what, the veto override is the next step?
Well, it'd actually be easier to impeach this governor because it only takes a majority vote of the House and then a supermajority vote in the Senate. And there are a lot of talking about, there's a lot of talking about doing that very thing because of what we're seeing. And I think, you know, a recent example of just how out of touch this governor is that the governor closed right-to-know offices. The General Assembly, made up of 50 senators and 203 House members, currently 202 with one vacancy, overwhelmingly voted. When I say overwhelmingly, 252-0 to reopen the right-to-know offices so that people can get information about how the Wolf administration is operating. And as we're recording right now, the governor has threatened to veto this. He keeps doubling down and saying he will veto this. And a number of editorials saying, what does Governor Wolf have to hide in this? And I think it's become very clear he has a lot to hide because he has been making these decisions unilaterally without input from the General Assembly. And even when the General Assembly, 100%-0, says we need this information, he's thumbing his nose and using the disaster declaration as his vehicle to operate as the sole determiner of what's going to happen in Pennsylvania.
And it just goes to show, again, the wrongheadedness of that state Supreme Court decision, because it's not possible that the people who wrote that law meant for things to proceed this way. Because, I mean, you could have – I've said this before, and this is not hyperbole because events have proved it. You could have a governor take office, declare an emergency, and then stay in emergency wielding these extraordinary powers for the fullness of his term. That's very scary.
Until you got a two-thirds override vote to a veto. That's exactly right. Yeah. So you have a self-perpetuating, executive who has unbelievable powers. And that's what we're seeing here. And there has to be a fix to that.
Yeah, again, it's saying we're going to have a standard that's higher than impeachment in order for our elected officials to be able to weigh in on lawmaking and the execution of those laws. Because right now, Governor Wolf, under his emergency declaration, he's effectively both making law in the mandates that he's passing, he's overriding law, and he's ignoring the will of the people through our elected officials.
Well, and there's another example that's very timely that we need to discuss of the governor acting unilaterally and cutting out the General Assembly in the decision making, and that is the governor's insistence on imposing a carbon tax on Pennsylvania's energy production sector. It's this compact, the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, RGGI, they call it REGI. And that Wolf wants to impose this regimen on Pennsylvania without the consent of the people's elected representatives. The legislation passed the House overwhelmingly, like 130 votes out of 202. It's,
yes.
It's on to the Senate. But again, there's a very strong bipartisan consensus that the legislature should be involved in these decisions, including the imposition of taxes, that the power of taxation belongs exclusively to the legislative branch, and that Wolf says he's going to veto this too. It's like, well, then where do we go?
Well, in that case, there's even a little bit of a disagreement over whether or not the governor has the authority to do the REGI initiative. He is arguing that he does under the Air Pollution Control Act. And a lot of folks say that absolutely is not true. He does not have the authority. So I think the fact that he's gotten away with so much in the realm of executive powers recently that he's gotten used to it. And he's planning to go full steam ahead despite the votes against it in the legislature. And we'll see how that plays out, because eventually it could end up in court. Of course, but it is another executive initiative that the governor is pushing, which arguably he does not have the authority to do.
Well, I think that this goes to the constitutional crisis that you raised at the very beginning of this program, David. I mean, this is about our separation of powers. It's about checks and balances. And clearly, Governor Wolf wants to disrupt that. He wants to usurp many of the legislative powers into the executive branch by using executive emergencies or emergency declarations, as well as just stretching it when it comes to these things and testing those limits. I think that, you know, most people would say, look, that's the wonder of our system that allows for a legislative, executive, and judicial branch to balance these things, that things should take time, things should require compromise, because that's how we get to a better result. Empowering one sole body at the expense of all the others, I think, is where you get into trouble. And I think, thankfully, we're seeing movement. We see a constitutional amendment that passed both the House and Senate with bipartisan support to start limiting the power of emergency declarations. But it's pretty clear we're going to have to revisit a lot of these things, given the power grabs that we've seen under Governor Wolf.
And our system is fragile. Our system is fragile in that every time the Constitution is not respected, and that every time one of these politicians gets away with with slipping the bonds, that it sets a new precedent and it expands the power of government, and that's extremely dangerous. I, you know, call me old fashioned. I would want to have public servants who want to serve in these offices to exercise the powers responsibly and to live within the limits that the Constitution sets, that it shouldn't just be an opportunity, Matt, like you said, to see how much you can get away with. Respect the office, respect the parameters that the Constitution set, and try to be effective using those powers, you know, that you've been properly granted. So anyway, that's the world I want to live in, even though we live in this one. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. As ever, it's a great pleasure to be with you folks. Matt, where can the listeners go to learn more about you and your group and the things that you do?
Go to thecommonwealthpartners.com.
And Rebecca, where can people find you?
You can find us at nfib.com/PA or on Facebook or Twitter.
And as ever, you can find me online at pamanufacturers.org and on the Pennsylvania Cable Network on Sunday mornings at 8:30 with PMA Perspective. So from Matt, Rebecca, and me, thanks very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time on Capital Watch. And now, a town hall commentary from Loman Henry.
Thank you, David. Normally, which of course nothing is, the high drama in July of a presidential election year centers on who the presumptive nominees will select as their vice presidential running mates. COVID-19 and civil unrest have instead dominated the national discourse. But with Democrats set to hold some variation of a nominating convention in about a month, speculation is mounting on who Joe Biden will choose. Should Biden be elected in November, he will become the oldest person in American history to ascend to the presidency. That, coupled with growing concerns over his mental acuity, makes his vice presidential selection more meaningful than is typically the case. Despite the obligatory bromides of having a running mate capable of becoming president on day one, Biden has chosen to play identity politics with his pick. Months ago, he promised to select a woman. Such a selection would not be historic. Congresswoman Geraldine Ferraro became the first woman nominated for national office by a major party when she ran with Walter Mondale in 1984. And then Alaska Governor Sarah Palin was the first Republican woman when she ran with John McCain in 2008. History is not on Joe Biden's mind, but checking the identity box is. Recent events have potentially narrowed that search to a black female, although Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren remains a top contender as Biden attempts to pacify the ultra-left wing of his party. Not having "ready from day one" as the top criterion is deeply concerning, given the very real possibility Biden may not be able to complete a full term. And even if he does, he has already limited himself to one term, making his pick the automatic front-runner for the Democratic presidential nomination in 2024. Ready from day one has often not been the foremost factor in vice presidential selections. The second slot has often been used to bind the party together after a hard-fought convention, as with the selection of Chester A. Arthur, who was James A. Garfield's running mate in 1880. The office has been used for electoral balance, such as the selection of Texas Senator Lyndon B. Johnson, who ran successfully with John F. Kennedy in 1960. But vice presidents do, usually quite unexpectedly, become president. The first vice president to be suddenly thrust into the chief executive's role was John Tyler. William Henry Harrison had delivered a lengthy inaugural address in inclement March weather. He became ill and died just 1 month into his term, making his the shortest presidency in history. The nation's 12th president, Zachary Taylor, succumbed to illness, elevating Millard Fillmore to the presidency. Interestingly, Taylor had never even met Fillmore until several days before their inauguration, as they had been paired by delegates at the Whig National Convention. Of course, the first president to be assassinated was Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln's first vice president, Hannibal Hamlin, had been replaced on the 1864 ticket by Andrew Johnson. In historical retrospect, that appears to have been a major mistake, as Johnson became the first president to be impeached, escaping removal from office by just one vote. Regrettably, other assassinations have followed. Just months into his term, James A. Garfield was shot by a disgruntled office seeker. He lingered for several months before dying and passing the presidency to Arthur, who proved to be a capable, if unremarkable, replacement. Likewise, William McKinley was failed by an assassin's bullet in 1901, thus elevating Theodore Roosevelt to the presidency. Roosevelt became a major political force and is regarded as one of the nation's better chief executives. Again, in 1963, tragedy struck when John F. Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas, Texas, and Lyndon B. Johnson finished the term and was then elected to one of his own. Two other presidents passed away in office, leaving the presidency to successors who are generally highly regarded. President Warren G. Harding died in August of 1923, putting Calvin Coolidge in the White House. And on April 12, 1945, just days into his fourth term, Franklin Roosevelt passed away, resulting in the presidency of Harry S. Truman. The nation has been generally fortunate that accidental or unexpected presidencies have turned out reasonably well. Nobody can predict when again a vice president will be called upon to lead the nation. Therefore, identity, ideological, and even ticket-balancing politics should be set aside, and ready from day one should be the penultimate criteria. With a Town Hall commentary, I'm Loman Henry. If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, LincolnRadioJournal.com and LincolnInstitute.org. For 25 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WRYV-FM in State College, WROV-FM in Ridgeway, along with WRXC-FM in the Altoona-Huntingdon area. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, and the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.